This is the audio from a recent Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube video. We've stripped the audio so that you can listen on the go.
I think it was in Edmonton you had to go online and reserve a picnic table where you could drink your booze.
So you reserve a picnic from the local council.
Yeah. They say that the liquor industry is pulling from the tobacco playbook, mm-hmm. but they're playing directly from the anti-tobacco playbook.
Even people who are basically prohibitionists are reported to be liberals. But what happens when we get to a point where people just don't even care about that stuff anymore? And they're quite happy to say, I'm not a liberal. If they don't like this, we're going to ban it. Hello, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. This is Christopher Snowden. You are watching another episode of The Swift Half with Snowden, the half-hour TV interview chat type show where we don't drone on and on like these losers like Joe Rogan and people that nobody's interested in. We have a nice, pithy conversation. We've already had one, in fact, with my guest this week, Dan Malik, who is Professor of Health Science at Brock University over in Canada. He was on the show just under a year ago. We were talking about the crazy new Canadian alcohol guidelines and also talking about the conflict between liberalism and progressivism and various other things. He is mainly a historian, and we didn't talk that much about history. Maybe we shall this time, Dan. Dan, he's in London, okay? We're in London, folks. We're in the heart of Westminster, and I thought it was a shame, since Dan was in town, not to get him on the show again, and it's very nice to see you in the flesh, Dan.
Great to see you as well.
So what brings you to Britain?
Well, I'm here for a conference. Well, a conference last weekend on drink. There's a network called the Drink Studies Network, and I'm here for that to talk about some of the stuff we talked about the last time, actually, and how it affects historians and how we should be writing about this, or how I think we should be writing about this. I don't want to tell everyone what to do. And then this week, I'm doing some research at the National Archives and the Pharmaceutical Society Museum.
Very good. So let's talk a bit about history and history of prohibition in particular. I think a lot of people don't realize that Canada had full-on alcohol prohibition around about the same time as America did, as did Russia, Finland, yeah. Iceland, quite a few countries. It's not just an American story. So what was this? Was this Canada copying America or what?
No, they usually copy us. So it's a long history. We only have half an hour, so I'll try to make it quick.
Yeah.
In Canada, our constitution divides authority over alcohol between the provinces that have authority to sell, like to license vendors, and the federal government that has the authority to license manufacturers, right? So if you want to restrict manufacturing, it has to be federal. If you want to restrict selling, it has to be provincial.
Right.
And routinely, they could not, the temperance movement just could not get the federal government to restrict the sale for various reasons. The manufacturer saying, hey, this is our property, you know, we have a right to do this, all of those arguments. And so the temperance movement turned to the provinces. And so in some provinces, in the East Coast, especially Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, they managed to secure province-wide prohibition through something called the Canada Temperance Act, which was basically a plebiscite. You'd have a plebiscite and people vote. And the rest of the country, that didn't happen until the war. So when the war started, anyone knows anything about the war knew that within a few years, there was a huge resource crisis. So people started to be concerned about, or the temperance movement started to articulate concerns really about the, about grain, about human, about manpower or human resources, about the manufacturing capacity. And so I think in about 1916, by about 1916, most of the provinces had passed some kind of temperance law, some kind of prohibition. Prohibition on sales, not on making it, right? And then around 1617, the federal government passed a law that basically banned or required provinces to ban sales and something like that, and restricted the manufacture until 1 year after the end of the end of the war. Of course, they didn't know then when the war would end, so it actually came into effect in 1918. And then 1 year after, some of the provinces, like Quebec, for example, which really didn't get behind it ever, rescinded it right away, created a public, like a provincial liquor control board where you would buy your booze, but allowed wine and some beer to be sold in corner stores. And then basically it went west, roughly west to east. So in 1921, British Columbia rescinded theirs. So right after the war, most provinces had a plebiscite again, and they agreed to continue prohibition. But then the province I'm in, 1927 in Ontario, it ended and they created the Liquor Control Board. So that's where we get, if anyone's been to Canada or anyone's in Canada right now, they know every province has weird liquor laws. And that's where Ontario's weird liquor laws began. Well, not where they began, but where they were sort of firmed up in this provincial agency.
Which was the last province to repeal?
Prince Edward Island in 1948.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they, and in fact, they have this really funny, as I had a friend who lived in PEI for school, for university, and she said there was a speakeasy in Charlottetown, the capital, until I think late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. And it was the thing, everyone went to the speakeasy, even though it was legal, right? But it was just this thing, right? I mean, I've been to towns where there are speakeasies or after-hours clubs and things like that, which are not legal. But this was kind of like almost this cultural thing that everyone pointed to as like, this makes us unique.
Okay.
It doesn't sound as if Prohibition went terribly well from that.
No. Well, this is the funny thing, especially in the eastern provinces in Canada, the East Coast, or what some people call the Maritimes. They had this maritime drinking culture, and they're sort of known for, if you're going to Newfoundland, for example, which wasn't a province of Canada during the First World War, there's this whole thing about drinking rum and kissing a cod as being, they call it being screeched in, because screech is this weird rum, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's like becoming one of us sort of thing. So, and the maritime culture in the eastern provinces, really had this huge drinking culture attached to it, right? Drinking and music and all of that stuff that you would expect, you know, sailors and all that stuff. But it had a huge evangelical temperance community as well, and they basically dried up most of the provinces. Although I suspect part of the reason why they got away with it was because people who didn't want it may have voted against it, but they may have just said, oh, I know how to get it. That's fine. We'll get it in.
I think there's a lot of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
People kind of supporting Prohibition but not really agreeing with it and thinking it's not really going to affect me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it doesn't if you don't drink.
Even if you do drink,
you might think, well, you know, it's like, well, there's plenty of people who smoke cannabis who don't particularly want to legalize it.
Yeah.
If you can get hold of it perfectly all right, they might smoke it. They don't necessarily want everyone smoking it.
And we found, actually, is speaking of cannabis and Prohibition, when Prohibition ended in Canada, a lot of people still went to their guy, right? It's like I would speak to friends of mine, say that I knew smoked, and I said, "So, are you going to the store, the provincial store, or the legal store?" Like, no, I go to my guy. If that's what they would say, like, I got my guy.
Yeah,
Brian, right.
Well, you can see that very clearly in the data.
Yeah,
because Statistics Canada has a really good cannabis portal online.
Yeah,
and we were there. I was there. I think about a year after it was legalized nationwide, 2019. I was there with the BBC and some MPs to see how it was working out. And we spoke to all these police officers and people in, did kind of the rehab and what have you, various people, a whole section of, you know, stakeholders.
Yeah.
And they're all very keen to tell us this has gone really well.
Mm.
But it was obvious from the data that most of it was still black market, right? Most of the market was still illicit. People were going to the old dispensaries or they were just getting off the street. Mm. And then we went to the shops, of which we were in Toronto, there was like, I think we told there's four or five shops for the entire metropolitan area, but there was some 11 million people.
It's like, it's
clearly not. Yeah, good. I'm pleased to hear it has. But there was clearly an undersupply of the shops. The shops themselves are really sterile. Mm-hmm. The weed in there was really expensive and horribly packaged to try and put you off it. So it's no wonder people just carried on buying it, because they weren't going to get in any legal problem from carrying on buying it from the guy, right?
Yeah, I mean... So again, there's these two elements of consuming, right? One is being where you purchase it, and one is where you consume it, right? So when cannabis was legalized, they kind of took the worst of alcohol and tobacco laws and put them together, right? So you couldn't consume it in a public build, like in a public building, right? Like, so you couldn't have a licensed premises like you would have a bar.
Because of the smoking ban.
Because of the smoking ban,
yes, right.
And you couldn't consume it outside, say, in a park or something like that, because that's just, well, that just wasn't a thing.
Yeah, and you can't drink outside most of the time.
Because you can't drink outside. Yeah. Although now many municipalities are reconsidering that. So we've had the post-COVID and during COVID, this real hand-wringing about, oh my goodness, we're letting people drink in the park, so...
Oh, yeah, you had a temporary exemption for this during COVID.
We did, because that was municipal, so most... In some provinces, the provincial government had to pass a law to permit municipalities to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so in other provinces, they already had this rule. And places like Vancouver, which is, if you've been to Vancouver, you know that now people smoke weed all the time everywhere. So it's a very legal, that's a bit of a characterization, but, or a mischaracterization, but it's legal. And so there's a liberal sort of sense of where you can consume things. So North Vancouver and Vancouver started to allow drinking in public parks, but they had, and Edmonton, Calgary, a whole bunch of cities did. They even had these weird laws, right? So I think it was in Edmonton, you had to go online and reserve a picnic table where you could drink your booze.
So
you
reserve it from the local council.
Yeah. Yeah. And a few of them had this.
For me, it's usually a spontaneous thing, drinking in the park.
Right. Yeah. So, but then what they also did was said, if there is a like these licensed picnic tables, and no one's sitting at them, you can sit there and have a drink. So it was kind of like they're trying to be overly restrictive, but then they're like, oh, people, who's going to police this? Right. Mm. Like you might once in a while have a cop coming up going,
you got a license for that beer.
Yeah, but they don't. But we don't, right? It's not like we needed a license to carry beer anymore. We did in 1927 to buy it. So it was they were trying to do this sort of control mechanism, but I think everyone was half-hearted about it. You know, the people, basically it's one of those things where you create this rule, like a speeding limit, right? Where you can go over the limit, but if, you know, something happens and you were going over the limit, then you were going over the limit. You know what I mean? Like, normally they wouldn't stop you. So you've got someone drinking in the park and everything's fine. And then people start getting in a fight or something, which rarely ever happened because of booze, although everyone thought that would happen. And then you could kind of look at how legal what they were doing was. And,
yeah. So, yeah, it kind of keeps people in check.
Yes.
The cops can bust you if they want to.
Yeah, it internalizes controls, right? It's very much something that... we've been doing for decades, at least, if not hundreds of years, but I'd say decades.
So going back to the alcohol prohibition for a minute, did Canada have its equivalent of Al Capone or its Valentine's Day Massacre? Yeah. Or was it much more modern in Canada?
No, we did. I mean, the end of the whole prohibition period, it sort of went like this. Federally, as soon as that wartime law ended, even I think a little before that, you could start manufacturing again. And in Ontario, Right. Wine was never, making wine was never illegal because they were trying to nurture the wine industry.
Do you have much of a wine industry?
It's good. It depends on who you talk to.
I've never come across Canadian women.
I live in a region that's a very heavy wine region. It's kind of like Canada's version of the Napa Valley, as far as like massive numbers of wineries. A lot of like tender fruit growers are turning to grape growing. There's a huge wine tourism industry there. So people from the Napa Valley would go, yeah, you might think it's Napa Valley, but it's not nearly the kind of quality. But we have some good stuff, right?
Sure.
They were trying to nurture that. And actually, the Liquor Control Board was involved after Prohibition with actually actively nurturing the wine industry.
Mm-hmm.
But distillation was legal after Prohibition, even in provinces where it wasn't legal to sell it.
Yeah.
And brewing. So a lot of brewers had already begun to figure out how to move their booze across borders, provincial and federal. And the distillers, the Seagram's industry, the Bronfman's made their money. This isn't slander. It's documented. They made their money on Prohibition. Like, they made tons of money moving booze to the U.S.
Yeah. Right?
They had connections with people like Capone.
Right.
And we did have our own gangsters, like our own illegal vendors and gangs and stuff like that, but we were also a big provider.
What was the political justification for allowing the production when the sale was generally illegal?
I think it was just at the federal level they were seeing...
The temperance people must have hated that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. Federal, it was really hard to get federal laws passed. Part of it, and I don't know how much of this was the fact that in Quebec it was hugely politically unpopular, and Quebec was a large population, so a party's fortunes could rise or fall on having some support in Quebec. We did have, they were nurturing industry, right? So nurturing industry in whiskey production, for example, and in beer production. So, you know, what are you going to do with all this grain we're growing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was a huge, like the multiplier effect of the liquor industry was something they were concerned about. You know, you're getting these maltsters, these farmers are not having a market for their grain, right? And then there was sort of a convenient looking the other way, right? So we hear stories of rowboats leaving Windsor, Ontario, which is, it's on the Great Lakes, but it's like deep into the the continent, we're going to Cuba with this rye. We're going to Cuba with this rum. And then they come back a couple hours later empty, right? Right. So, and then for a while, customs didn't care because they knew what was happening, but policing the U.S. laws was not their job.
Yeah, that problem. Yeah.
Yeah, they did get an arrangement with the provincial or the American government managed to convince the Canadian government to crack down on this because I can't remember the reason. There was some other kind of, it was part of a bigger deal that they made about cross-border relationships, but it's still a lot of stuff, especially on the coasts. I mean, you could get stuff heading down the coast. And even, I mean, we have islands off of Canada, Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon, which are French, right? So it wasn't illegal there. So sending stuff to Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon was not a problem, right? So there was these little loopholes, like geographic loopholes and political loopholes that were exploited to the benefit of Canadian manufacturers, especially because in the U.S. it was banned. The manufacturer was banned, right? So when Prohibition was coming to a close, when the 21st Amendment was being ratified, the Canadian producers were like just sitting. Oh, they were sitting on the border, ready to.
Oh, they're ready to go because
they had the capacity
because then they could sell it, but no one had time to make it.
That's right. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, usually, you know, whiskey would need to sit in barrels for a bit,
right? But that was kind of the last hurrah for the for the Canadians on this particular enterprise.
It was still a pretty big business, right? But yeah, I mean, then we see multinationalism growing, but still, Canadian whiskey, Canadian Club, all of those were and still are fairly iconic brands. And there were a few big distillers who were picking up, like the Seagram's especially. Seagram's Group was just picking up brands around the world.
Bringing the temperance movement to the present day, let's go back to these guidelines.
Temperance movement anymore.
Of course not. So the guidelines, folks, if you didn't see the last episode, I haven't read about this, recommended guidelines from the CCSA, which stands for the
Substance Use and Addiction, CCSA.
They said that the, not even the safe level, but you know, the safe-ish level is to have two drinks a week.
Two standard drinks a week.
Two not very big drinks a week.
No, like 12 ounces of 5% beer.
Yeah. Right?
So that's not a lot.
And you were one of the few people in Canada actually publicly saying this looks a bit shifty, which is not really your job as an historian, there's nobody else really doing it, right?
Well, the thing about, for me, when I read the strange thing, I don't know, tell me if this normally happens, but a big think tank puts out a report for public consultation, like kind of crowdsourcing your science, in August of 2022. And I was actually heading off to go drink with a bunch of my colleagues. And I read this thing and I just kind of saw the temperance movement all over it. I saw the language of temperance. I saw the distortions that are used by people who want to kind of misrepresent evidence. And I'm a historian, but I do have I understand a bit of numbers. Like, not a lot of historians are really good number people. So I looked at this and went, oh man. And I just started swearing up and down with my friends. And they said, you know, maybe you should do something about this. Well, yeah, I'm going to write about this, right? So then I spent the next 6 months kind of writing and talking to media. And then four months, something like that. And in January, they released the final report. And then they did another big media blitz. And then places like the British Columbia Public Health Unit picked up on it and started their own campaign based upon this new distorted data. Right. And as you know, there's a few people in British Columbia, at University of Victoria especially, who are very actively pushing this, just what I call distorted.
Yeah. So when you say a campaign, you mean like a public-facing advertising campaign?
Well, yeah.
Do you not drink more than two small beers a day?
Posters, bulletin boards, like
really?
The bus shelter ads, huge. It was called,
wow.
The campaign's name was The Proof.
The Proof.
Yeah,
ironic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they like those clever word usages, right? And they doubled down on this evidence of, you know, alcohol causes cancer and alcohol causes heart disease and stroke and all of that stuff. That's the causation, that word cause is really problematic, right? Because some evidence shows it can increase your risk, but like when you talk about something like breast cancer, risk factors in breast cancer are complicated, right? It's not just like if you have too much beer, you're going to get breast cancer as a woman, right? So when they say they're trying to do the they say that the liquor industry is pulling from the tobacco playbook,
mm-hmm.
but they're playing directly from the anti-tobacco playbook,
yeah,
right?
Which is projection,
yeah,
100%.
And the difference is, of course, the components in tobacco that when it's burned were carcinogenic, but alcohol, like some of them, right? But alcohol isn't in itself carcinogenic. It's a process that goes on in the body that makes a carcinogenic substance, but then the liver breaks that down right away. Unless you drink a lot.
And unless you drink a lot.
Have a lot of it.
Which is more than 2 drinks a week.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so the question is really, what's a lot, right?
Right.
And I'd be genuinely interested to know what it is. You know, as a drinker, I'd quite like to know what a genuinely dangerous level of drinking is. But you're not going to get it from these ridiculous studies. And I think most people who are drinkers will certainly look at that, 2 drinks a week, but also look at the UK ones, which is essentially 1 drink a day.
A day, yeah, yeah.
And just go, well, I mean, I know so many people who drink a lot more than that and they're fine, so yeah. I don't trust these scientists. But you were saying in the last interview, which I actually weirdly hadn't really thought of, is some people, members of the public, do see these adverts and go, oh my God, I'm killing myself, I'm going to get cancer.
It really worries a lot of people, and I had a lot of people reach out to me, and like, I even have family members. The reason I started the second kind of phase of this is a family member to me said, tell me why I shouldn't be worried about this. I feel like I'm drinking too much. I said, well, if you feel like you're drinking too much, that's one thing. But if you look at their numbers, I mean, because it's a personal choice, but if you look at their numbers and say you're drinking too much, here's some things to think about. And I sort of broke down how they use their data and how they misrepresented things and how they sort of were skewing evidence in a certain narrative, right?
Yeah.
And even some of the language they use. Like they have a big infographic that says the consequences of drinking alcohol. Well, consequences are moral judgments, right? Truth or consequences. The consequence of doing this as opposed to the effects of, right? Mm. Which is less moral judgy, right?
Right?
No, but they use this language, the consequences. They talk about... one of the things they say that's really spurious, and they even contradict it in their own report, is that if you drink more than 7 drinks a week, radically increases your chances of getting heart disease and stroke. And there is no radical increase at all. I mean, they
decrease, if anything.
Well, up until, so what they've done in their final report is there's a sort of a table for men and for women. And it lists these different illnesses, and they only looked at things that will kill you, right? So they didn't look at things like mental illness and stuff like that, which, you know, can kill you if someone kills himself. But they were looking at things that have a direct relation to death.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we all die, so everything has a direct relation to death. But anyway, well, that's philosophical stuff aside. And so they look at 1 drink, 2 drink, 3 drink, up to 7 drinks. A week, and then the table jumps to 14 and 20, 21 and 28 and 35, right? And so you see this color-coded increase in the percentage. So it's relative risk. It's the percentage increase in risk of getting this condition,
yeah.
Right? And up to 7 for women, because alcohol is a little more protective for women than for men, up to 7 drinks a week, you still have a decreased likelihood of getting ischemic heart disease. And
you have to drink a lot. I mean, a genuine lot before you see an increase in heart disease.
Right. So remember, they say over 7 radically increases.
Yeah.
So the next column is not 8, it's 14.
Right.
And at 14 drinks a week, the number goes up to, I think, 5%. So it's a 5% increased risk between -7 or -5 and +5. Now, I don't know. I don't know what radical means.
Yeah.
You know what it means, but that is no radical increase. But they're using this kind of language, right? And so they're using blood red coloring on the higher percentage increase. They're looking at things like liver cancer, and they're saying 1 drink a week actually does increase your likelihood of getting liver cancer. And that's just doesn't make any sense, because what happens is your liver's pounded by a lot of alcohol. But I think what they do is extrapolate backwards.
Yeah.
And say if 20 drinks a week increases your likelihood this much, then, you know, let's just project back.
Because you have to, because there's just not enough people who only drink 1 drink a week to study.
Not to mention, the other thing is they average it across weeks, when someone could go on a binge once a month And their liver won't be able to process that alcohol very well. If you're just like pounding shot after shot after shot and then not drinking for a month,
yeah.
And it may actually increase because you have this carcinogen in your body for longer because the acetaldehyde, I don't know how to pronounce it right, is carcinogenic. Normally the body breaks that down right.
You can see how that's the goal start.
Yeah.
Acute harm, is it?
Yeah. It's like sitting in a, it's like hot boxing cigarettes, right? It's just sitting there or sitting there, I don't know, with another carcinogen flowing through the air and you're breathing it in, you're going to increase your likelihood. But the data is just, it's kind of wacky, man. But they are adamant about this.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to a number of them and they really, they're not like glazed-eyed idiots or zombies or something. They're just like, no, it's, look at the numbers. Like, I don't think you quite understand what we're saying. It's like, oh yeah, I understand what you're saying. Absolutely. And then I've spoken to some of the people who wrote this and they don't actually understand the report. Like I would talk to them about some of the evidence that they use. Like, oh no, we use that stuff here. It's like, no, you didn't. I'm like, you don't even know what you said, but not everyone's buying it, but people are paying attention and getting scared.
Yeah.
And that's what really bothers me because we do know there is evidence that stress and anxiety and fear and worry can increase health risks, right? So if you're unnecessarily worrying someone, then you're possibly harming them. And that's making them
unhappy for no reason, yeah.
Yeah.
When we spoke before, I watched it back to make sure we didn't repeat ourselves in that. Okay. We were talking about liberalism and progressivism. And, I mean, in this country, people don't really know what progressives are, but I think progressives make it that way, right? They're really not quite disclosing what the difference is between them and liberalism and socialism. But I said in that interview that to date, even people who are basically prohibitionists are purported to be liberals. But what happens when we get to a point where people just don't even care about that stuff anymore? And they're quite happy to say, I'm not a liberal. If they don't like this, we're going to ban it. In the last 12 months in Britain, they've been terrible from this perspective. It's been a really depressing time from a libertarian perspective. Not only have they kind of got away with minimum pricing being a flop in Scotland and presented it as a success, not only have they got away with the sugar tax being a flop and presenting it as a success, in both cases, obesity and alcohol related to deaths went up, but they're going to double down on it. We've got this ridiculous scare about ultra-processed food, which is based on nothing at all, really, apart from our best-selling book. And we've got the looming actual prohibition of not just cigarettes, but snuff, cigarette papers, pipes, cigars, everything, every tobacco product, heated tobacco, the whole lot. And that really has been a case of, I'm not a liberal, I don't like it, I'm going to ban it. You know, and we haven't got to that stage now, weirdly, less than a year since we last spoke, where the government is saying, this is bad for you. We don't care if you're an adult or a child, you shouldn't be using it, and we're going to stop you using it. And you will never be old enough to buy this because it's bad. And at that stage, what do you do? It seems pretty, it's been very depressing.
Yeah. We've had elements of that. It's not been as strong. I it seems to be really, there's something going on here that
this. I knew it would happen. I just didn't think it would happen here first. You know, when New Zealand announced it, I thought, yeah, that makes sense. New Zealand's the kind of place that do that.
Yeah.
But then they saw sense on it.
Yeah.
And now it's just UK standing alone.
Yeah. I really don't. Yeah. I mean, you tell me, man, I really don't understand the sort of bloody-mindedness about this. It's like, we just need to stop people. There's an arrogance to it, right? There's this paternalism, this arrogance of just, you're not doing what we're telling you, and so we're going to have to force you to do it. And I don't know where that's coming from. And I don't even know, I mean, it's progressive. I mean, people who, you know, in the UK, like you said, you don't really have this idea of progressivism, but I don't even think a lot of people in North America really call themselves progressive. Some in the US do. But there's just this idea of using the mechanisms of public health to help people, because they're not able to help themselves. But there's this other thing. And so in my business in health sciences, because I'm actually a historian in the health science department, we talk about the social determinants of health, right? So how housing, education, poor access to food, low income can affect your health. But there's this term, you explain this to me if you can, the commercial determinants of health, this idea that somehow we're all being duped by
businesses,
and therefore we need to be protected from our own naivete. Or
I really object to the use of the word determinants there, because it sounds a bit too determinist. You know what I mean? It's like, no, you have absolute choice to ignore this advert or not buy this product.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
No, in case of addictive products, you know, I'll accept there's another argument to some extent.
Yeah.
But even with nicotine, not so much. People go, well, smoking's terribly addictive. Well, actually, it's nicotine that's addictive to some people. Only about half the people who use nicotine actually are addicted in any real way. And there's so many other nicotine products on the market now that people are kind of avoiding all the alternatives, or they've tried them and don't like them, and they still want to smoke. I think at this point we can say, well, maybe we should just let people smoke.
Yeah,
rather than go down this road where historians really do have some evidence to bring to the table of you know, what's going to happen if we prohibit this thing.
Yeah, and so the medical officer of health for the city of Ottawa submitted a brief to the federal government about suggesting the New Zealand model of prohibition of tobacco, right? That whole anyone born after 2008 or whatever will never be able to buy it. And I was, I spoke on a radio show with a guy who actually, he does smoking cessation stuff for people who have like cardiovascular disease. So his career is built on tobacco, but he wouldn't admit that his career is built on smoking cessation. And he's a big anti-tobacco advocate. And let's be clear, I don't like smoking either. I never have done it. And I'd like, if someone wants to do it, go for it, right? Just don't blow it in my face, you know, that kind of thing. But he was adamant. He said the weirdest thing. He was, because he gave his side, and then I said, well, you know, prohibition doesn't work. And what's going to happen if this goes on is people are going to find a way to get access to it. Not to mention the fact that, so you've got a 15-year-old today who won't be able to buy cigarettes. But when they're 35 and they have a 36-year-old friend who can, it's going to be a meaningless prohibition. But now you've got a 35-year-old person who is not allowed to do something that a 36-year-old can.
So it's still on sale in the shops.
Yeah, exactly.
A very weird kind of prohibition.
Yeah, so it's this weird thing where you really think those people aren't going to be able to get it. And they, anyway, so this guy, he said, well, first of all, he thought it was industry. And I'm like, I'm not.
They'd like to throw that one around early.
Yeah, they do that because they can't imagine anyone except someone who has a financial interest in it would disagree with this. And then he kept saying things like, well, we have no evidence that prohibition doesn't work. This is all theoretical. And I sat there thinking, what? let me count the ways, right? Yeah. Not only do we have the examples of alcohol prohibition not working, but in my province in Ontario in the 90s, they really jacked up the tobacco tax and the black market flourished like no one could believe. So when a new premier came in, he dropped the tax and then the black market was weakened, right? So there's that.
Yeah, I remember that.
And then we have this toxic drug crisis. Like we have people taking drugs that are illegal, that are laced with things they don't know what's in them, and dying. And it's not just an overdose crisis, because that suggests that people are overdosing intentionally. Mm-hmm. It's actually there's stuff in there that's toxic and what it is, yeah. Right? So these are that is an immediate public health concern, and that's because of prohibition, right? So when people say this, I think, what planet, like not even planet, what universe, what part of the multiverse are you from? Because this one, prohibition doesn't work.
Historians are kind of interested in things that actually happened.
Yeah.
I guess that's what gives us the advantage over some public health people. They just say whatever they want. There's a prohibition didn't work. Minimum pricing, the sugar tax, they worked.
Yeah.
Obesity went up. Those policies worked. Prohibition, no evidence it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Apart from every time it's been tried.
Yeah.
We're up against our time, I'm afraid. Thank you, folks, for tuning in. We shall be back in a couple of weeks. Please support the IA in any way you can. Go to the website, follow us on YouTube, like and subscribe, donate to us, ia.org.uk/donate. And take care of yourself. Until we meet again, take care, goodbye, and God save the King.